right. Hi, Luke. Thank you so much for joining me. I was wondering if to begin you would be willing to introduce yourself because I've often given introductions for people and then I've, just gathered information from Google and I've been wrong and that sort of thing.
Yeah, sure. I'm Luke Gittos. I'm a lawyer based in London. And for about the last 10 years, I've written for Spiked Online, which is a current affairs publication. I'm a columnist there, and I write mainly on the interaction between law and politics. I've also written a couple of books, the latter of which is Human Rights Illusory Freedom, Why We Should Repeal the Human Rights Act.
Great, thank you. So I think for most self-respecting lefties these days, the idea of repealing the Human Rights Act sounds like a right-wing, terrifying kind of policy. Why do you think it's we shouldn't be afraid and we should open up to this idea that it's perhaps human rights are not as progressive as we think they are?
I think it was the left's attitude to this question which motivated me to write the book, because historically the left has always been very suspicious of the state enforcing and protecting freedom, and particularly suspicious of the law's ability to enforce and protect freedom. The Labour Party were always very sceptical throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s of what was broadly a conservative movement to further codify our rights at the level of European institutions. The Labour Party was very sceptical of the idea of judges having the power to decide how free we should be. And it's really only with the 1990s onwards, I'd say, that the left has really come behind human rights as a project, or international, transnational human rights as a project. I think it's important to also distinguish between human rights as a system of law and human rights as the left might once have argued for them. So the left, I think, has always been concerned with calls for what we might call human rights, which arise in the form of calls for greater solidarity, calls for greater autonomy, limits to arbitrary or centralized power. And how we see human rights today, which is effectively a system of law which has grown up in the second half of the 20th century and is administered by courts both in this country and in Europe. What I think has been interesting is that the left have, I think, reorientated themselves around defending the legal codification of rights and the legal institutions and laws that defend our rights. And I think often at the expense of the traditional historical idea of human rights, which was more situated in our political community, and in democracy. And I think that we can come on to talk about this a little bit more, but I think what that has translated into, or is exhibited in, is the left's kind of suspicion of democracy and democratic movements to help secure better human rights. They have come to trust the law and judges and institutions far more than they do the people and democratic movements to defend individual freedom. And I think that's a negative development.
Yeah, I think that's really, really interesting. And I want to talk a little bit more about democracy and freedom, as leftist conceptions and maybe where perhaps that's been lost a little bit. But I wonder if we could just delve into a little bit more around this history. So you mentioned that this was a broadly conservative movement. Now, that might seem a little bit peculiar because a lot of the people who were involved in the codification, the initial codification of human rights law, were, socialists, were they not? So how was this a conservative movement?
I put the contrary case. Marco Durante, who is a human rights scholar, has just published a fantastic study on this, which is called "Human Rights: The Conservative Re Well Co cons Something along the lines of the Conservative Human Rights Revolution," and he really points out that, especially in Europe, if you look at the initial Congress of Europe, which occurred in 1948, in the aftermath of the war, and was effectively the seeding point for both the European Union and the European Court of Human Rights. If you look in detail through the dispatches that arose and the reporting that arose from that initial Congress, firstly, all the people there were conservative and largely Catholic conservatives. So a big pioneer of the human rights movement was Winston Churchill, and a lot of the political leaders that assembled there were from parties of the European Christian right. And that makes sense when you look at the ideas which are at the heart of what came to be the European human rights movement. You know, notions of human dignity are largely the notions of human dignity that came embodied in international human rights law were largely borrowed from Catholic notions or religious notions of human dignity, rather than, you know, the rights of the French Revolution or anything like that. So it was firstly just the people on the ground in Europe in 1948 who gave rise to the European Human Rights Project were largely Catholic conservatives. But then if you look at the detail of how these particular pieces of international, transnational law came into being, you see that actually socialism was edited out of the early drafts of these international treaties. So if you look at the fantastic work of that's so insulting, I've forgotten her first name, but the Rise of Human Rights by Sellers, I've forgotten her first name now. But what you can see if you look at the early drafting of these documents is that countries, for example, in South America that were looking to sign up to international human rights treaties often lobbied for the inclusion of rights like the right to worker self-determination or the right to rebellion, all of which were seen as extremely dangerous by the crafters of human rights law in the West. So in the early drafts, they're actually edited out and pushed to the sidelines. Socialism is actually removed from the Human Rights Project gradually by those in the West who were keen to actually shore up Western capitalism from the threat of the Soviet Union. It's important to remember that a lot of our human rights institutions come into existence when Western capitalism was feeling deeply under threat by Soviet communism. And I think it's right to see human rights as in part a kind of ideological response to the threat of communism as a system of values. And it's really an attempt for Western capitalist countries to present that in order to be free, you have to adhere with human rights, which and so they were attempting, I think, to define freedom in their own image, as opposed to the vision of freedom or as opposed to the political ideology of the Soviet Union. So I think it's actually right to see human rights as coming into being in opposition to socialism rather than protecting it.
I see. So, but would you not say that maybe, I mean, it's a really tough argument to make. I mean, it's a bit like motherhood and apple pie, it seems, human rights. But the end result has been the protection of certain rights and freedom, has it not?
Well, it has, but at the expense of others. So we know that, and I think, again, we should go back to this, but it's important to draw a distinction between what we might call human rights with a small HR, so the kind of call for, you know, what we might traditionally think of as human rights, as in calls for solidarity, resisting arbitrary power, etc., and the human rights institutions and laws that we have in the West today. So, I mean, if you look at the latter conception of human rights, so human rights laws and institutions, actually, I would argue that the passing of the Human Rights Act into UK law, you know, that occurred in it takes its passage through 1998 and finally becomes law in 2000. You know, that foreshadows one of the most draconian periods of lawmaking in recent English law legal history. You know, you have the new Labour government passing many thousands of new, you know, something like 3,000 new criminal offences in the subsequent years. You have the passing of the regulatory, the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, which occurs in 2000-2001, which granted massive new powers to the state to regulate and control our freedom and to introduce new methods of surveillance. But then you also have the massive growth of, you know, antisocial behavior legislation, which and harassment legislation, which, as we've seen, you know, they have become key in the control. They're the reason why people can now today be sent to prison for what they say, because, you know, persistent violations of harassment legislation, or the new breed of harassment legislation, or persistent violation of the new antisocial behavior legislation can land you in prison for what you say and do. So I think it's worth pointing out that the kind of rise of human rights in the sort of 70s, 80s, and then finally into the UK in the 90s and 2000s precipitates a period of very draconian lawmaking. And I think because of the structure of the Human Rights Act and the way that the European Court of Human Rights and the British courts proceed, it's not often very effective in preventing draconian lawmaking. And, you know, neither should it be. It's also worth pointing out that the courts shouldn't have a role in shaping our laws. That is the role of the legislature. It's the role of Parliament to propose and pass laws. But I think what the Human Rights Act does is it gives the illusion that human rights are being protected, when in fact the passage of law that we see completely unaffected and uninhibited by human rights legislation actually makes us less and less free. And there's a danger, which is why the book is called Illusory Freedom, that relying on courts and institutions gives us a false sense of security about how free we actually are.
Okay. All right. I want to drill down a little bit more into what you said, but I'm also really interested in the history. So I'm kind of going back and forth about whether or not to follow this thread or take us back a little bit. Yeah. So I'm going to take us back, and I'm going to come back to the question of what sorts of things. I want to go back to what sorts of things you see as emblematic of, you know, relying on the judiciary. But going back to the Hague Congress in 1948, you mention, I think, in the book about the specter of Nazism and the threat of communism constantly being presented and the two being elided. I wonder, could you say a little bit more about that? How did this idea of Nazism and communism come together, and the idea of human rights as this bulwark against these sorts of things, how does that sort of feed into the human rights narrative?
Well, I think I would call it the founding myth of the human rights movement was that democracy, an untrammeled democracy, has the capacity or even ends inevitably in tyranny and despotism. So if you look at the Congress of the Hague Congress, you see this idea begin to germinate among European elites that both communism and Nazism were both the result of untrammeled democracy. Now, of course, you know, in their they're rather self-serving in this regard. You know, Churchill was looking at the recent election of a socialist, broadly socialist government in his own country, and was extremely wary of the spread of that ideology across of Western Europe. So, part of the means of combating the possible spread of socialism was to elide Nazism and socialism in the popular imagination. And what that translates into, I think, is, you know, conservative elites across Europe feeling as though they are losing control or had lost control and lost moral authority in significant ways. The Sellers book that I mentioned talks about the complete perceived failure of the war crimes tribunals in Japan and then later in Jerusalem to bring a kind of morally authoritative conclusion to the conflict. These were, you know, the West was really struggling, I think, or that's the argument at least of the Sellers book, that the West was really struggling to maintain its moral authority in the aftermath of the war. It had no consistent and definitive political response to what had happened. And so conservatives are starting to see that really they're losing control over the public imagination in the aftermath of the conflict, and so seek then to present socialism and Nazism as the natural consequence of untrammeled democracy. So again and again, Churchill enforces the need for transnational institutions by painting the spectre of the Holocaust as the result of them failing to intervene and failing to come together. And so that myth really persists throughout the human rights narrative up until today. If you look at a lot of the human rights publicity, you know, campaign groups looking to campaign for human rights or legal human rights today, they constantly refer back to the Holocaust and will constantly use footage from far right rallies today, and then show it alongside footage from the Holocaust and say, well, this is what happens if you don't have human rights laws. And, you know, that is really echoing Churchill and others at the Hague Congress. They're saying that if you allow the people to govern themselves without any judicial control, then what you have is the inevitable rise of despotism. So that's how I think the founding myth originates. But then it's important to remember that human rights really remain quite a niche project for at least a few decades. You know, most people in Britain or the rest of Europe wouldn't have heard of the European Court of Human Rights until, you know, the 1990s, 1980s. We were able to take cases there, but really it was the interest of a very narrow group of individuals, again, mostly conservative lawyers, who tended to see, you know, it was part of a very niche area of interest until it became the interest of New Labour in the 1990s. And we could come on, if you like, to talk about how I think that anti-democratic sentiment at the heart of the Hague Congress comes to be echoed in the New Labour idea of human rights and New Labour's idea of why human rights are important.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think,
it's absolutely at the heart of both the originating formulators of our human rights framework and at the heart of today's contemporary human rights movement, I think.
I think that's really interesting, the way that democracy and freedom now on the left kind of have this, you almost put them in scare quotes. They have this kind of right wing ring to them. And actually, a friend of mine was telling me that a few nights ago he was at a party and he was talking to this woman who fancied herself to be a progressive kind of person. And she said, and he was, you know, talking about Brexit and about the need to implement something that was a democratic decision. And she became quite hysterical, he said. His words, not mine. And she said, "What would you do when Hitler was coming to power, and people voted to expel the Jews and so on?" And he said he didn't know what to say to that. But that's become a very common idea. This idea that we need to limit democracy, and then people will throw sort of Hitler's rise to power in. What would you say to something like that?
Well, look, we probably don't want to get too much into the Nazis, but it's an important lesson from history that it's not straightforward to say that Hitler was straightforwardly elected in the normal way. You know, he was shuffling himself to power. He never, it's more complicated than people often like to pretend. But I think it's important to also say that this is why going back to a sort of a political idea of human rights, I think, is very, very important. And I think it's important to... I was considering the work of Hannah Arendt when I was writing this book, and she is often considered as the forefather of the contemporary human rights movement. You know, when people talk about human rights law today, they often refer to Hannah Arendt, who was writing in the kind of key moment when human rights come to the fore. As a kind of foreshadower of international human rights law. But I think it's more complicated than that. Arendt's case is that really what we need to do to ensure ourselves against a repeat of Hitler, if you like, or any repeat of a radical delineation from human rights standards, is to actually ensure and protect human rights in our political community. So she's really writing about stateless individuals in the aftermath of the First World War, which included Jews and gypsies and vast swathes of the European population. And what she saw really was two things. Firstly, that they had been they legally existed outside of any community. and that therefore could not rely on the state in order to protect their rights. But then she notices that really they have been removed in a more broader sense from any political community whatsoever. So not only could they not rely on their state to protect them, Aaron's case is also that they had no political community into which they could strive for autonomy and protection. And it's that lack of a political community for Arendt which is really key to the loss of their human rights. Arendt's conception of human rights is one based on the extent of respect we extend one another as citizens. You know, she talks about, you know, and she's a bit of an Aristotelian in this regard, I think, but she talks about the loss of human rights as a removal from any political community, the loss of the what she calls the right to have rights. So she sees rights at both the level of state protection, but more importantly, as the rights that exist between each other, one another as citizens, and the kind of respect that we extend to our citizens. So I think the best way, I think the best answer to this point about Nazism is to say, look, we can't be so blasé as to rely on the law to prevent this happening again. You know, because law has never been a very good protector when we are faced with tyranny. When we are faced with tyranny, the law either supports or maintains the tyrannous, or it does very little to protect those against whom tyranny is targeted. And, you know, Arendt makes this point in another of her books, Responsibility and Judgment, and she echoes it in Eichmann in Jerusalem, where she talks about how, you know, the Nazis had lots of laws, but the laws were fundamentally vacated of their moral content, or they were, you know, what happened was murder became legal. So it's her point is consistently that it's insufficient to rely on the law to protect us and to protect what we might call small HR human rights, you know, in individuals' right to self-determination and autonomy. Historically, the law has been a poor for those things, and also a huge slander. So if someone says to you, well, what would you do if you have a repeat of Hitler? Firstly, you point out that the law will probably not protect you in that situation, but then go on to point out, look, the democratic movements and the people have been far more effective at securing the greatest advances in human rights throughout history than the law has. So, I mean, if you name any significant advance in what we might call human rights, you know, the civil rights movement, the end of slavery, the greater freedom for LGBT people, all of these things are not the result of the law getting more involved in people's lives. It's the result of popular movements forcing the law out of people's lives. It's about processes of decriminalization. It's about processes of assertion against the use of law to limit people's freedom. The processes of the impact of public democratic movement has been far more significant in the processes of history and in the history of human rights with a small HR than the kind of sclerotic and unchanging institutions of the European court and the British courts have ever been. The law always catches up with popular sentiment. So I think that's the most important lesson we can take from history.
I wonder now, it seems that we're kind of going the opposite direction in terms of mass movement. So you said that it's always been about trying to get the law out of your life. It seems like now there are more and more calls from apparently progressive people to bring the law more and more into people's lives. How do you think that's happened?
I think it's partly because the law has become a system of validation for people. So I think in our age of identity politics, the law has become a forum through which people claim validation for their particular identity. So we've seen this, for example, in the gay cake case that arose in the course of last year, where two homosexual men ordered a cake that was purporting to, I don't know, promote gay marriage. It was a cake with Bert and Ernie on it. And the Christian Bakers refused to do it. They were sued. Eventually, the Christian Bakers themselves were cleared of all wrong. Well, the case against them failed. But it was obviously a long, drawn-out process. What I think that case shows is that human rights law and equality law, which are sort of part of the same nexus, I would argue, are being used to make claims from the state to validate people's individual identity. And I think that's having a really destructive impact, actually. When you look at the cases, for example, of Jessica Yaniv in Canada, who is using human rights law in order to compel beauty technicians, female immigrant beauty technicians, to wax her genitals, her male, biologically male genitals. We've seen really the kind of degradation of the idea of human rights into a forum in which people can claim status and validation for their particular identity. And I think that's going to have an increasingly corrosive effect on small HR human rights, actually. I think the more we call on the courts to kind of draw hard and fast lines between people's identities, the less capacity we will have for solidarity, but also to work out the difficult cases on our own terms. We will become far more reliant on the courts and institutions to adjudicate these cases for us. And the most dangerous thing I think that could happen is that these identities, people's individual individual identity claims, become codified in kind of in law in different formats. And that is a real recipe for social disintegration, actually. If the courts start recognizing one claim to identity more than the others, as we saw the risk arising in the context of the Gay Kate case, you know, you're being asked to balance Christian freedom of religion against, I don't know, I suppose a couple's right to buy whatever they want, wherever they want. If you're being asked to make that case, then the law is being invited to balance the kind of identity claims of two separate groups. And inevitably, that will result in an authority which comes down on one side. And I think that's a recipe for social fracturing. And I think that's where human rights law actually gets its most dangerous edge.
These are really complex moral questions. So in the book you write, our fear in the face of the arguments for repeal show how dependent we've become on the law and the judiciary to answer the complex moral questions thrown up by contemporary life. But how else do you envision we would answer these questions?
Well, I think the word is informally, and I think there's a lot to be said for informal resolutions of these difficult problems, and often difficult problems are better solved by people than by judges. So this is really going back to Arendt's idea of conception of human rights. What she is talking about is how we might come to balance our own individual moral priorities in the context of particular situations. And I think what should have happened in the context, taking a specific example of the Gay Kate case, is that the homosexuals should have bought their cake somewhere else. I think that would have been the morally right thing for them to do, recognizing that their decision had an impact on the moral compass of another individual, and making a judgment about what to do. And we should hold people accountable for their moral decisions in those particular circumstances. You know, Jessica Yaniv should simply find someone who is willing to wax her genitals, rather than using the law to compel people to abide by her view of what is morally right. And so I think what we need to do is resolve situations informally far more than we do. And of course, you know, it goes without saying that these problems are resolved in everyday life all the time. But what I think we are witnessing is the creeping in of law and pseudo-law into the realm of individual judgment. So to take another example in the sphere of schools, you know, I'm also interested in the area of, you know, how we socialize children into making moral decisions. And I think more and more of that process is being governed by things like local authority guidance, safeguarding. We see that, and all of these are forms of the law. They take the decisions of the courts and translate them into guidance and policy, kind of policy dictations for local authorities, which then translate into guidance for kind of our institutions like schools and hospitals and things like that. So we see the law kind of creeping into more and more areas of our life. And, Lord Sumption talked about this in his recent Reith lecture, you know, the kind of massive expansion of law and guidance at the expense of individual judgment. And you can see this in many areas of life. And I think the risk there is that really, we no longer take the decision ourselves and we no longer trust our fellow citizens to make those decisions ourselves, we test their decision as against a guidance document, a policy document, a decision of the courts. And that really is a depreciation of the space in which moral decisions can be made. Because we're no longer making moral decisions, we're making our decisions based on what we are told by the authorities. And so I think it's subtle, but I think we are seeing, with that growth of more and more law, we're seeing the depreciation of our ability to make political and moral decisions that we stand by in the context of the public sphere. And I think that's very dangerous.
Well, what do you think comes first? Do you think there's this lack of faith in our ability to make these judgments that leads us to rely on codification? Or do you think it's the other way around? I mean, why do we rely so much on codification? It seems like there's every day, it's like there ought to be a law against such and such. What's underlying that? What are the deeper sort of drivers?
I think the appeal to juridification in public life is driven by a decline in what we might call common values and the rise of, and I think I'd appeal to a kind of broader social fracturing. You know, we lack the kind of common values that we may once have had to make decisions. And we're no longer, I think identity politics has an important role to play in this, which is, you know, the fracturing of people into smaller and smaller identity groups mean that the common language for resolving moral and political problems has become more difficult to apply. And so there does not appear to be a common societal response to the issue of, say, transgenderism, or, say, the issue of how we educate our children about sex, or how we educate our teenagers about relationships, or what to do in the faith people who want to exercise their religious freedom. We have no common societal response to those questions. We have no set of values through which we can formulate a response to those questions. And so the law becomes a replacement for that system of values. It becomes a purportedly objective way of resolving these questions. So I think that the deeper symptom here is, in part, a collapse of any kind of common framework through which to resolve moral and political problems. And I think that, in turn, can be blamed on the kind of decline of, the decline of the institutions that used to socialize us into moral thinking. You know, we no longer have the church, our political parties, our trade unions. We no longer have these institutions that may once have given us our own political and moral perspective on a particular issue. You know, you might once have been able to predict how someone might think about a particular problem based on the membership of their political party, for example. That is now completely gone out the window. You know, talking to someone, if they are a Tory, gives you no indication on where they, on how they might think about an issue like transgenderism or how to educate kids about sex. Whereas 30 or 40 years ago, if you were a Tory, you might be more broadly conservative and might think that, and might bring certain values to bear on that particular question, i.e. the need to maintain a degree of the status quo, to pass on particular social values. It's not so clear anymore that your political affiliation, your affiliation to any political party, or your membership of a religion, or your membership of a trade union will dictate your position on any particular issue. And I think in its place has arisen the rise of juridification and the law.
I tend to think also that there's this, if you're going to have like a societal ownership of freedom, of human freedoms and rights, it requires a certain belief in human subjectivity and political subjectivity that is characterized by the ability to actually deal with freedom, that you have the ability to reflect, for instance, on your emotions and rationally choose how to act. I feel like there's a part of this story that is about the decline in belief in that kind of subjectivity, this idea that human beings are ill-equipped to deal with freedom, that underlies some of the erosion of these freedoms, but also I think maybe puts us on fails to put us on a firm footing if we're going to move these debates outside of the law. I mean, how do we do that when we have a society that fundamentally doesn't really believe that human beings are capable of dealing with freedom at all.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And part of this picture is, in order to be free, we have to have a strong faith in the individual to be sufficiently robust to, one, assert their freedom, but also to accept it when their own freedom is curtailed in the name of something beyond themselves. So in the case of the gay cake scenario, what I think we would need in that situation is to be confident enough to tell these particular homosexuals is that this isn't the forum to vent to express your individual identity. There is something bigger at stake here. And no matter how emotionally distraught you are by the fact that you are unable to buy your cake at a particular baker, there is something larger at stake than your individual hurt and your individual feeling of invalidation. And I think that goes for the transgender case, but also goes for cases, you know, where human rights are perhaps deployed more regularly. You know, for example, in the context of immigration cases, which is where I think human rights law is deployed almost on an industrial scale nowadays, sometimes successfully, more often not. You know, what's at stake in these cases is we have to be able to say that our notion of social good often overrides an individual's right to validation, and that requires quite a strong sense of the individual as a robust right-bearing subject, and also an understanding of our political community. Now, that political community can't be summoned out of nowhere, but I think we have to at least recognize that the individual, if an individual is to be a rights-bearing subject, they need to recognize that rights-bearing is more important than their individual emotional well-being. And I think the human rights we have today really express more, have become more about facilitating individual feelings of validation than they have about political freedom. And so I agree in the sense that if we are to have the kind of political community that Aaron talks about, we need to encourage people to conceive of themselves as robust individuals who are capable of making moral decisions and judgments, and also to make it clear that there will be occasions where individual self-interest come up against the interests of a society and a political community, and the latter will have to take precedence over the former.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you then to say that we need to be careful of and stand up against emotional blackmail as well, because people will bring up, you know, threats to emotional well-being as being equivalent to physical threats now. And I think that's a mistake. But I suppose the other side of that is that people will make, for instance, around the gay cake case, people have drawn similarities with, you know, racial exceptions. So, you know, the signs in the windows of, you know, no blacks, that kind of thing, whites only. Yeah. I mean, is it not the same sort of thing? Aren't these movements, aren't these the result of movements to protect people from that kind of discrimination?
That's true. I think, you know, Aaron talks about, I just keep going back to Aaron, but it's always worth doing. You know, Aaron talks about the difference between repealing discriminatory laws, which, you know, the majority of the civil rights movement was about removing discrimination as exercised through law. So the legal framework that allowed for segregated buses and shops and things like that, you know, the situation in apartheid South Africa was not merely that private individuals were discriminating, it was that the law juridified and codified their discrimination. And it therefore gave discrimination the power of the state. And the civil rights movement in America and also the end of apartheid South Africa represented the repeal of discriminatory laws, but didn't end individual discrimination. You know, it didn't end people's feeling that they didn't want to give their services to particular individuals on the basis of the color of their skin. But the only way to resolve that problem is to engage people politically. There is no way you can. But what we're seeing today is the kind of use of the law to compel people to make the right moral decision. And there's a big difference between that and repealing the law in order to allow people the space to make the right moral choice. you know, in her essay on Little Rock, Arendt talks about the position with regards to segregated schools and says, look, the difference, that there is a difference between repealing the laws which enforced racial segregation and legally compelling people to integrate. The problem with the latter is that you don't resolve the political problem. You actually put it on the heads of the people who are involved in these political disagreements. You force them to rub along together, when in fact the solution has to be engaging people politically, making sure they have the freedom to make a particular moral choice, and engaging them so that they do make the particular moral choice. And then eventually you reach a position where your political community is protected against discrimination, not because the law tells it to be, but because the people themselves don't want to discriminate. And I think that's the position we need to move towards.
Okay. We're running sort of low on time, and there's so many, I have so many more questions that I haven't got to, but I wondered just if I could just sort of apply your ideas to one case one area that's really close to my heart. So we all talk about human rights, and people talk about the EU as though it's this bastion of human rights. So how do we explain then, and does it fit into your thesis at all, the way that immigrants from outside of Europe are being treated? Is this an example of that, of a blind spot in human rights? How do we make sense of this issue?
Yeah, completely. I mean, look, European human rights law does nothing for non-EU migrants. You know, the European Convention on Human Rights does nothing to prevent migrants from drowning in the sea. And I think it's right to see non-European migrants, much like Arendt saw European Jews and Gypsies in the aftermath of the First World War. These are effectively stateless people who, you know, that there are similarities between what Arendt saw and what we're seeing today, which is the removal of people from their political community. I mean, and a displacement of people. And the response of Europe has been, I've not been inclusive to defend what we might call small HR human rights. That the advances we have seen, you know, where human rights protection does work is where political communities make the political decision to accept and accommodate new people into their community. But the best way to promote that is to ensure that people feel as though they have a control over how people come to live and be in their community. So I think the major problem with the response of European governments to the migrant crisis was effectively to take the question of how to resolve it completely out of the hands of the European publics. You know, Angela Merkel's announcement about opening the borders of Germany effectively denied the rights of states on the outer perimeters of the European Union to make decisions about their borders for themselves, led to huge influxes of people, and meant that communities in poorer areas of Europe felt the brunt of the decisions of political elites in richer countries. And I think that's a recipe for a failure to protect human rights, because it does and has bred a degree of resentment about the people who are moving through that community.
Yeah, so if you force people to make these moral, quote-unquote moral decisions, it leads to actually rejection of those morals.
Absolutely. That's what we're seeing over and over again. And, you know, the way we resolve the political question of how to resolve the migrant crisis cannot really be resolved solely in relation to human rights standards. It requires a balancing of different political priorities. And that's got to be done. The more we do this, I think, by reference to democratic approval, and the more we refer back to the people to resolve this question, the more likely that the solution that we come up with will be permanent and solid, because it will have the approval of the public who are affected by the decisions being taken. And I think, for example, it's not surprising that a country like Hungary has responded with some degree of hostility to the influx of migrants, precisely because they are a country who, across the last, you know, 50, 60, 100, 200 years, have had their right to determine the extent of their borders, or the paucity of their borders, taken away from them. You know, they've been invaded, subject to rule by the USSR. It's not surprising that the population there is deeply suspicious of large influxes of people over which they have they feel as though they have no control. And I think that explains the rise of certain right-wing parties in that country and elsewhere. You know, this is about public sentiment failing to public sentiment really reacting against the decisions of Western rich elites. And I think in order to better protect European human rights, what we need to start doing is throwing these questions back to the people in order that the answers that they come up with are actually sustainable.
Okay, I think we can leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. And I hope we will talk to you again in the future, because I still have so much more to say, so much more to hear from you as well, so many more questions. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Ashley.